First question. How does a guy on motor patrol in the dark spot a corpse hidden way the hell out here, deep in the trees? I parked next to him and took the flashlight out of the clip and slid out into the cold and immediately understood how. There was a trail of clothing, starting in the center of the track. Right on the crown of the camber was a single boot. It was a standard-issue black leather combat boot, old, worn, not very well shined. West of it was a sock, a yard away. Then another boot, another sock, a BDU jacket, an olive drab undershirt. The clothes were all spaced out in a line, like a grotesque parody of the domestic fantasy where you get home and find abandoned lingerie items leading you up the stairs to the bedroom. Except that the jacket and the undershirt were stained dark with blood. I checked the condition of the ground at the edge of the track. It was rock hard and frosted over. I wasn't going to compromise the scene. I wasn't going to blur any footprints, because there weren't going to be any footprints. So I took a deep breath and followed the trail of clothes to its conclusion. When I got there, I understood why my guy had thrown up twice. At his age, I might have thrown up three times. The corpse was face down in the frozen leaf litter at the base of a tree. Naked. Medium height. Compact. He was a white guy, but he was mostly covered in blood. There were bone-deep knife cuts all over his arms and shoulders. From behind, I could see that his face looked beaten and swollen. His cheeks were protruding. His dog tags were missing. There was a slim leather belt cinched tight around his neck. It had a brass buckle and a long tail looped away from his head. There was some kind of thick pink-white liquid pooled on his back. He had a broken tree limb rammed up his ass. Below it, the ground was black with blood. I guessed when we rolled him over, we would find that his genitals had been removed. I backtracked along the trail of clothes and made it to the road, stepped over next to the MP private. He was still staring down at the ground. "Where are we exactly?" I asked him. "Sir?" "No question, we're still on the base." He nodded.
"We're a mile inside the fence line, in every direction."
"Okay," I said. Jurisdiction was clear. Army guy, army property. "We'll wait here. Nobody gets access in there until I say so. Clear?"
"Sir,"
he said. "You're doing a good job," I said.
"You think?"
"You're still on your feet," I said. I went back to my Humvee and radioed my sergeant, told her what was up and where, and asked her to find Lieutenant Summer and have her call me on the emergency channel. Then I waited. An ambulance arrived 2 minutes later. Then two Humvees showed up with the crime scene specialists I'd called before leaving my office. Guys spilled out. I told them to stand by. There was no burning urgency. Summer got on the radio within 5 minutes. "Dead guy in the woods," I told her. "I want you to find that psyops woman you were telling me about."
"Lieutenant Colonel Norton?"
"I want you to bring her out here."
"Willett says you can't work with me."
"He said I can't involve you in special unit stuff. This is regular police business."
"Why do you want Norton there?"
"I want to meet her." She clicked off and I got out of my truck, joined the medics and the forensics people. We all stood around in the cold. We kept our engines running to keep the batteries charged and the heaters working. Clouds of diesel smoke drifted and pooled and formed horizontal strata like smog. I told the crime scene people to start listing the clothing on the road. I told them not to touch it and not to leave the track. We waited. There was no moon, no stars, no light and no sound, beyond our headlights and our idling diesels. I thought about Leon Garber. Korea was one of the biggest branch offices the U.S. Army had to offer. Not the most glamorous, but probably the most active and certainly the most difficult. MP command out there was a feather in anyone's cap. It meant he would probably retire with 2 stars, which was way more than he could have ever hoped for. If my brother was right, and axes were getting ready to fall, then Leon had already come out on the right side of the cut. I was happy for him. For about 10 minutes. Then I started looking at his situation from a different perspective. I worried at it for another 10 minutes and got nowhere with it. Summer showed up before I was finished thinking. She was driving a Humvee, and she had a bareheaded blonde woman in BDUs about 4 feet away from her in the front passenger seat. She stopped the truck in the center of the track with her headlights full on us. She stayed in the vehicle, and the blonde got out and scanned the crowd and stepped into the matrix of headlight beams and made straight for me. I saluted her out of courtesy and checked her name tape. It said Norton. She had a light colonel's oak leaves sewn on her lapels. She was a little older than me, but not much. She was tall and thin and had the kind of face that should have made her an actress or a model.
"How can I help you, Major?"
she said. She sounded like she was from Boston and not very pleased about being dragged outside in the middle of the night. "Something I need you to see," I said.
"Why?"
"Maybe you'll have a professional opinion."
"Why me?"
"Because you're here in North Carolina. It would take me hours to get someone from somewhere else."
"What kind of someone do you need?"
"Someone in your line of work."
"I'm aware that I work in a classroom," she said. "I don't need constant reminders."
"What?"
"It seems to be a popular sport here, reminding Andrea Norton that she's just a bookish academic, while everybody else is out there busy with the real thing."
"I wouldn't know about that. I'm new here. I just want first impressions from someone in your line of work, is all."
"You're not trying to make a point?"
"I'm trying to get some help." She made a face.
"Okay."
I offered her my flashlight. "Follow the trail of clothes to the end. Please, don't touch anything. Just fix your first impressions in your mind. Then I'd like to talk to you about them." She said nothing, just took my flashlight from me and set off. She was brightly backlit for the first 20 feet by the MP private's headlights. His Humvee was still facing the woods. Her shadow danced ahead of her. Then she stepped beyond the range of the headlight's illumination, and I saw her flashlight beam move onward, bobbing and spearing through the darkness. Then I lost sight of it. All that was visible was a faint reflection from the underside of leafless branches, far in the distance, high in the air. She was gone about 10 minutes. Then I saw the flashlight beam sweeping back towards us. She came out of the woods, retracing her steps. She walked right up to me. She looked pale. She clicked the flashlight off and handed it back.
"My office," she said, "in 1 hour.
She got back in Summer's Humvee, and Summer backed up and turned and accelerated away into the dark. "Okay, guys, go to work," I said. I sat in my truck and watched drifting smoke and flashlight beams quartering the ground and bright blue camera flashes freezing the motion all around me. I radioed my sergeant again and told her to get the base mortuary opened up, told her to have a pathologist standing by first thing in the morning. After 30 minutes, the ambulance backed up onto the shoulder and my guys loaded a sheet-draped shape into it. They closed the doors and slapped on them, and the truck took off. Clear plastic evidence bags were filled and labeled. Crime scene tape was wound between tree trunks. It was tied off in a rough rectangle, maybe 40 yards by 50. I left them to finish up by themselves and drove back through the dark to the main post buildings. Checked with a sentry and got directions to the PsyOps facility. It was a low brick structure with green doors and windows that might have housed the quartermaster offices way back when it was built. It was set at a distance from post headquarters, maybe halfway to where Special Forces bunked. There was darkness and silence all around it. But there was a light burning in the central hallway and in one of the office windows. I parked my truck and went inside. Made it through gloomy tiled corridors and came to a door with a pebble glass window set in its upper half. The glass had light behind it and Lieutenant Colonel A. Norton stenciled on it. I knocked and went in. I saw a small, neat office. It was clean and it smelled feminine. I didn't salute again. I figured we were past that point. Norton was behind a big oak army-issued desk, and she had it covered with open textbooks. She had so many on the go that she'd taken her telephone off the desk and put it down on the floor. She had a yellow legal pad in front of her with handwritten notes on it. The pad was in a pool of light from her desk lamp, and its color was reflected upward into her hair.
Hello,
she said. I sat down in her visitor's chair.
Who was he?
She asked. I don't know, I said. I don't think we'll get a visual ID. He was too badly beaten. We'll have to use fingerprints, or teeth, if he's got any left in there.
Why did you want me to look at him?
I told you why. I wanted your opinion.
Why did you think I would have an opinion?
It seemed to me there were elements in there that you would understand.
I'm not a criminal profiler.
I don't want you to be. I just want some input, fast. I want to know if I'm starting out in the right direction. She nodded, swept her hair back off her face.
The obvious conclusion is that he was a homosexual, she said. Possibly killed because of it. Or, if not, then with full awareness of it on the part of his attackers.
I nodded.
There was genital amputation, she said.
You checked?
I moved him a little, she said. I'm sorry, I know you asked me not to.
I looked at her. She hadn't been wearing gloves. She was a tough lady. Maybe her classroom-bound reputation was undeserved. Don't worry about it, I said.
My guess is you'll find his testicles and his penis in his mouth. I doubt if his cheeks would have swelled that much simply from a beating. It's an obvious symbolic statement from the point of view of a homophobic attacker. Removing the deviant organs, simulating oral sex.
I nodded.
Likewise, the nudity and the missing dog tags, she said. Removing the army from the deviant is the same thing as removing the deviant from the army.
I nodded.
The foreign object insertion speaks for itself, she said. In the anus.
I nodded.
And then there's the fluid on his back, she said.
Yogurt, I said.
Probably strawberry, she said. Or maybe raspberry. It's the old joke. How does a gay man fake an orgasm?
He groans a bit, I said, and then he throws yogurt on his lover's back.
Yes,
she said. She didn't smile. And she watched me to see if I would. What about the cuts and the beating, I said.
Hate,
she said. And the belt around the neck? She shrugged.
It's suggestive of an autoerotic technique. Partial asphyxiation creates heightened pleasure during orgasm.
I nodded. Okay, I said.
Okay what?
Those were your first impressions. Do you have an opinion based on them?
Do you?
She asked. Yes, I said.
You first.
I think it's bogus.
Why?
Too much going on, I said. There were six things there. The nudity, the missing tags, the genitals, the tree branch, the yogurt, and the belt. Any two would have done it. Maybe three. It's like they were trying to make a point, instead of just going ahead and making one. Maybe trying too hard. Norton said nothing. Too much, I said again. Like shooting someone, then strangling him, then stabbing him, then drowning him, then suffocating him, then beating him to death. It's like they were decorating a damn Christmas tree with clues. She stayed quiet. She was watching me, deep inside her pool of light. Maybe assessing me.
I have my doubts about the belt, she said. Autoeroticism isn't exclusively homosexual. All men have the same orgasms physiologically, gay or not.
The whole thing was faked, I said. She nodded, finally.
I agree with you, she said. You're a smart guy.
For a cop? She didn't smile.
But we know as officers that to permit homosexuals to serve is illegal. So we better be sure we're not letting a defense of the army cloud our judgment.
It's my job to protect the army, I said.
Exactly, Norton said.
I shrugged. But I'm not taking a position. I'm not saying this guy definitely wasn't gay. Maybe he was. I really don't care. And maybe his attackers knew, maybe they didn't. I'm saying either way, that's not why they killed him. But they wanted it to look like the reason. But they weren't really feeling it. They were feeling something else. So they larded on the clues, in a rather self-conscious way. Then I paused. In a rather academic way, I said. She stiffened.
An academic way?
She said. Do you guys teach anything about this kind of stuff in class?
We don't teach people how to kill,
she said. That's not what I asked. She nodded.
We talk about it. We have to. Cutting off your enemy's dick is as basic as it gets. It's happened all through history. Happened all through Vietnam. Afghan women have been doing it to captured Soviet soldiers for the last 10 years. We talk about what it symbolizes, what it communicates, and the fear it creates. There are whole books about the fear of grotesque wounds. It's always a message to the target population. We talk about violation with foreign objects. We talk about the deliberate display of violated bodies. The trail of abandoned clothing is a classic touch.
Do you talk about yogurt? She shook her head.
But that's a very old joke.
And the asphyxiation thing?
Not on the PsyOps courses, but most of the people here can read magazines, or they can watch porn on videotape.